Well, good afternoon, and welcome back to our Exodus series. We're in a final section where we're talking about the law, and so I thought maybe we'd start with a fun little story about the law. Back in 2012, a judge in a small town called Painesville, Ohio, handed down kind of a unique sentence to a woman named Sheena Harden. So Sheena had been repeatedly caught driving on the sidewalk just to avoid stopping for a school bus that was either dropping off or picking up kids. She did this over and over and was repeatedly warned by law enforcement to stop until finally a judge, you know, came down on her dangerous actions. And so he decided to issue her a unique punishment. Instead of just imposing fines or license suspensions, he ordered Sheena to stand on the street corner holding this sign: "Only an idiot would drive on the sidewalk to avoid a school bus." So she stood there in shame in front of everybody. I'm not sure for how long, but kind of a unique sentence. Is that fair? Is that just? Is that kind of a better way to deal with this? We're going to talk kind of along these lines today. Last week, we started through a new piece of this section. Our executive director, Eric Russell, started through this piece on other laws, quote-unquote other laws. Basically, these are more specific laws that followed or came out of the Ten Commandments that we looked at a few weeks ago. And so we're continuing today in chapter 21 in verses 12 through 46. And as I read through these verses and was kind of digesting this in preparation for today, a few things struck me. The first thing is that in this section, God's not only providing laws, but he's also providing punishment. He's telling the people of Israel how to punish transgressions against these laws. So I thought, you know, maybe we should talk a little bit about that today. Is punishment something that's deserved? And the punishments that God mandates, are they fair? Because as I started reading through this section and the laws and their corresponding punishments, I really found myself wrestling and bouncing around with a few questions. At times I was asking myself, does God go too far in what he's asking for punishment? And then other times I said, well, is God not doing enough to stop evil practices? And then I had to kind of ask the bigger question, is God truly fair and just? Sometimes, you know, he seems too harsh, sometimes he seems too lax, but there's actually a lot of these in this section that really do make a lot of practical sense, and it does seem fair and just. So where am I landing on this? And today's passage is relatively short, but it's actually very complex. The laws that, we're going to look at here touch on some pretty heavy issues, and they don't always have easy explanations. So I thought rather than reading through the entire text, because we could be here for hours explaining through these, we'll just look at a few specific examples. I'll summarize some of the others and try to wrestle through some of these questions with you, because maybe you're having some of the same that I had as I read these. Once we've done that, then at the end, we'll try to pull this all together and see if there's something we can kind of take away for ourselves today. So I want to start kind of with the toughest question that I was asking is, does God go too far in some of these punishments? And so why did I ask this question? Well, if you start reading at verse 12, immediately we start with five situations that require the death penalty. And so if you're someone who is against the death penalty, obviously this is going to make you feel very uncomfortable, like God is too severe in what he's asking for punishment. Even if you are in favor of death penalty and, you know, serious crimes of murder and things like that, there are still situations here that, you know, are going to make you uncomfortable as well. So I'm going to actually read this one through just so we can kind of get some context. So verses 12 through 17 says, "Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place to which he may flee. But if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. Whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death." So let's kind of fly through these. Obviously, the first couple of situations involve killing, involve murder. You heard two cases of hostility resulting in death. One in which a man intentionally strikes another man and that man dies. Another one involving premeditated murder. You kind of heard the words there. You know, he with cunning lied in wait to kill him. And so God obviously values and protects human life. He doesn't tolerate the murder of innocent. We talked a little bit about this a few weeks ago in the Ten Commandments. Commandment number 6, thou shalt not kill. We also see that God establishes this really early on in history. You know, back in the book of Genesis in chapter 9, he instructs Noah to go out and multiply and fill the earth. But then he follows that by saying, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. So as bearing the image of God, human life is valuable and should not be killed. The second situation we just read was kidnapping. This is also a capital offense, and specifically talks about kidnapping for the purpose of selling a human being into slavery. Obviously, kidnapping is a very serious crime, but you can kind of see how we're starting to get into maybe some questionable territory. Like, it's serious, but is it deserving of the death penalty? Here in Canada, kidnapping at its maximum sentence could get you life in prison, but there are other countries in the world where it's still punishable by death. And so this is another place where we see God's incredibly high value of human life. You know, slavery, we've touched on this a few times in these chapters in the past few weeks, but it was a reality in ancient times. But you can see here, God forbids his people from the cruel and dehumanizing practices that other nations allowed. You know, for those who like to attack the Bible on verses like these for condoning slavery, this particular law actually helps refute that claim, at least in part. Because you can see here, God forbids the slave trade to the point that he says it's punishable by death for anyone who kidnaps and sells another human being and anyone in possession of someone in that situation. So I'll just kind of trace through this again. We did, again, touch on this before, but there are two main types of slavery that would have taken place in Israel. There was, firstly, Hebrew slaves, and these were considered actually bond servants. They're people who enter into a legally binding arrangement to serve as a slave to a Hebrew master. And they're typically in this situation because they were in poverty, they were convicted of a crime, or as a means to work off a big amount of debt. The second type of slavery would be foreign slaves. So these would be people who are not Hebrew. They were most often prisoners of war. So now, you know, enslaving people as prisoners of war may not sound much better than kidnapping to us, but the reality is that Israel in the ancient Near East was engaged in war. They had to contend with other nations who were attacking them. God had rescued them from slavery out of Egypt and was leading them to a place that they could call their home. And so they were, you know, moving through the land, trying to occupy this place that God was leading them to. And in the process of war, they would take prisoners of the nations they defeated and they would become their slaves. Now, it looks a little different than what we know of slavery. The Hebrew slave masters, they could afford these slaves opportunities for all kinds of different social improvement. They could allow them to own their own property. They could engage in economic trade. They could get married to free people. They could hire free people. And some could even acquire their own slaves. So very different than what we think of. That's not to say that, you know, it was always a great situation, slavery. And obviously, you know, this whole scenario we're talking about, a world afflicted by war, is not God's ideal for creation. But at least the one thing we do know from these verses is that God strictly forbid slave trade. Kidnapping, forcing people into slavery, was a huge crime. Now, the last couple things that you saw in these kind of death penalty verses was some related to parents. Attacking or cursing a mother or father was also punishable by death. And so these laws obviously need some explanation. Especially the one when it comes to cursing your parents. Like, this is not a teenage outburst. This is not, I hate you, Dad. It's not, I wish you guys weren't my parents. Right? Most commentators agree that this was actually a complete rebellion and rejection of the parents. It was completely disowning them. And even beyond that, this was likely a very serious, deep-seated rebellion that had been ongoing and had been persistent. This is a child who is living a life of rebellion, and they've refused all discipline and all help and all correction to the point they're completely unrepentant and we're kind of at our last resort. Also, this is not something where the parents kind of just take these matters into their own hands, right? This is something that involves a legal process. This is something that happens under the guidance of the elders. And so there's a law described in the book of Deuteronomy that kind of expands on this idea. It says, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and though they discipline him, will not listen to them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gate of the place where he lives. And they shall say to the elders of his city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear. So I hope this kind of helps to understand the situation a little more, that it's more serious than just a verbal cursing of the parents. But you can obviously see where I would start asking, is God going too far here? Like, is he really asking for the death penalty in these kind of situations? Is that really warranted? Is that really what's needed? Sure, these need correction and punishment even, but are these crimes deserving of death? And so to answer these kind of tough questions, we've got to consider a bunch of things. Firstly, we need to remember these are not laws for us today. When we read these today, we tend to try to pull moral lessons out of them, and we can do that to an extent. But ultimately, these laws and their consequences were for covenant Israel. So remember that. That's who Israel is. The nation of Israel, at this time, their relationship with God and his purpose for them was very unique. Think about this. The infinite God of the universe has chosen this tiny people group to be a vehicle through which he would reconcile all of humanity to himself. He has rescued them out of slavery, and they have accepted the terms of this covenant, and they've entered into this binding agreement with them, this, you know, highest commitment we could probably ever imagine. Right? They've experienced his glory. They've seen his physical presence in the form of a pillar of fire and a pillar of cloud. Moses met with him in the desert face to face to receive these laws. And now they've agreed to live as a theocracy, as a government under God led by religious leaders. And so God's purpose in all this is to set them apart as holy. They were to be completely distinct and separate from all other nations on earth so that they could serve as his representatives to them, to this world that had rejected God and rejected who he is. And they were to show them who he truly was. They were to demonstrate God's character, his immensity, his power. They were to help people turn back to him and discover the goodness of his ways that had been lost to sin and corruption and violence. And so all that to say, the stakes in this could not be any higher. So you can imagine to do this, it was very important for God to preserve this nation. He had to keep it. Again, we use that word holy, meaning separated, distinct, apart. And he had to protect it, and he had to purge all evil from it. Otherwise, what's going to happen? It's going to deteriorate and become like any other corrupt nation. And we're back to square one. And remember what happened before when things were like this. He flooded the entire earth. Now, on top of all that, we also just have to remember who God is. He's the creator of everything. Everything. Like, he is the ultimate authority in the universe. Everything and everyone actually belongs to him because he made it. And he also made it to be good. And he's holy. He is the source of everything that is good. You know, nothing evil can even come into his presence without it being utterly consumed by this immense goodness. And also, he's the author of justice. Like, he created what justice is and what we think of as justice. He established this so that evil cannot go unanswered and so that good would prevail. And then very lastly, on just a very kind of practical level, I think we have to remember, you know, what I was mentioning about the parents. Punishment was that he was mandating was not to be carried out impulsively or out of anger or driven by vengeance. There was a judicial system, although it didn't look like ours today, right? They didn't have law enforcement in the form of like a police force. So the people of Israel, the elders, and you heard about like the men of the families, they are involved firsthand in upholding this law. But that doesn't mean they should just go out stoning people to death in the moment. This isn't, you know, the Wild West like a Yellowstone prequel where people are just, you know, doing what they want to uphold their law. There was a judicial process with witnesses and elders and authority involved. Now, all that said, you know, I've tried to give you some explanation, but all that said, I know even with all that background, that doesn't always make this enough to satisfy our discomfort with verses like what we've been reading. I mean, remember, we are talking about stoning people to death for cursing their parents. Like, this is pretty crazy by our mindset. So let's just pick that example apart quickly just to see how this plays out as well in a more specific example. So a couple things. First, the family and the community, they are crucial to God's redemptive work in the world. Like, if the family in Israel falls apart, then the entire nation of Israel eventually falls apart. It's built on family and community. And again, it just devolves into chaos again, and the world is no better off if that falls apart. I think we can look around and see living proof of this today, right? We know that the, the deterioration of the family has had direct correlations to things like poverty and crime and mental health and abuse and addiction and on and on and on, right? We see that even now. Secondly, the thing we have to see in a situation like this is rebellion against the parents actually equates to rebellion against God. You know, I'll just reiterate, God, he's the creator of everything. He is the authority over everything. And he appoints certain people on earth in certain roles to have authority as well under him, but over others. So parents over their families. And so I think one of the reasons passages like this make us comfortable today is because we live in a culture that doesn't really like authority, right? We have come to a point where we place personal autonomy and freedom as the highest value. And so when we see authority that seems too authoritative, we kind of get our back up. But we have to remember, the very idea of God demands that we accept some concept of authority. And think about the history that we know, rebellion against God's authority. Think of what that's caused. It caused an angel to fall from heaven named Satan. It caused mankind to fall into sin through Adam and Eve. So again, I hope some explanation helps a little, but I also am realistic enough to know that even with that, we can still be left feeling like God's punishment is kind of heavy-handed here. So let's just keep going, though, through our passages. Let's set that aside for a moment, because after wrestling through all these kind of difficult first sets of verses, as I read on myself, I found myself surprised to ask the next question, because very soon after I was asking, well, does God not actually do enough to punish and to eradicate evil? Because the next piece of chapter 21 goes on to talk about laws that involve assault and injury. So these kind of, you know, sound pretty straightforward until you get to a few verses like these. Let me read a couple. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. But if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, for the slave is his money. When a man strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall let the slave go free because of his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of his slave, male or female, he shall let the slave go free because of his tooth. So we're back into slavery again. And again, we've established that slavery in ancient Israel was much different than what we know of North American slavery. But we read this and it seems to presume that the masters here are beating their slaves, right? So does God condone the abuse of slaves? So another complicated issue that I think we need to consider a bunch of things. Firstly, I think one thing is that this is sort of a glass half empty, glass half full scenario in a way. Because for those with a glass half empty perspective who are looking to criticize the Bible, it's very easy to look at this and go, okay, clearly God condones slavery and the beating of slaves and all this terrible stuff. But with more of a glass half full perspective in defense of the Bible, we can actually see that God actually provides far more restrictions in Israel to protect the dignity and humanity of slaves than any other nation at that time. Everywhere else in the ancient world, slaves were considered nothing more than personal property, and masters could do anything they want with no fear of any repercussions. But here, God is saying that the master is subject to punishment if the slave dies at his hand, and that if he does anything causing any sort of permanent injury to an eye or a tooth or anything like that, then the slave must be given their freedom. So this was actually very radical. This is one of the ways God is setting Israel apart from other nations, by commanding more humane treatment of people, of all people, even slaves. And I think we should also be careful not to twist the focus of the law here, as maybe this top category would do. This law, the focus of it isn't about what God is condoning. It is about what God is restricting. That's what's the point here. Now, having said that, I realize if you read the words, there still seems to be this open door to corporal punishment of slaves, right? And so I think there are a couple of reasons or a couple of responses to this that we can look at. Firstly, those verses, they begin with if when clauses. You know, if someone does X, then you do Y. So this doesn't necessarily mean God is approving of these situations, but he's putting laws in place to protect people if and when they occur. Secondly, I think we just have to be realistic and look back and see that physical discipline was more common in history up until even closely to modern times. It was even recently, up until just recently, that the military, certain military still practiced physical discipline. So we maybe can't entirely discount the possibility that God allowed some type of physical discipline in some types of situations. If he did, I'm not sure we know exactly what those situations would be where physical discipline is acceptable or necessary. It does seem barbaric to us now, I think, to our modern mindsets. But I think we have to remember we're very far removed from the world of the ancient Near East. And so I was kind of thinking through this and wrestling through it. And here are some thoughts I have. I'm not a historical expert, so take this with a complete grain of salt. But I was thinking, you know, as these people entered into slavery, some of them are convicted criminals. Some of them have got themselves into incredible amounts of debt. Some are prisoners of war. But they're brought into their master's homes doing farm work and domestic work, and they've got access to everything, their homes, their families, and they play an immense role in these people's livelihoods, these owners' livelihoods. So this is a very interesting relationship that I don't think we have anything like today, right? It requires a lot of trust. It requires a lot of responsibility. And so what recourse did a slave owner have if something went really wrong in the situation? Again, there's no police force. There's no like law enforcement per se. This upholding the law was the responsibility of the community. So maybe this could account for some allowance of physical discipline in some situations. But, you know, then again, maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe there's nothing that justifies that. Maybe we don't really know the answer and we just have to let that linger. Sometimes that happens. We just have to have that question. Why would God allow this? And we're not sure. So here we are. I'm still torn. Is God too strict? Is God too lax? And so one more question remains, is God truly fair and just then? In spite of all these difficult passages we've looked at so far, I will tell you the rest of the chapter actually makes a lot of sense. It makes us feel that God is a God that is fair and just. I'm not going to read all of it for you today, but if you take the time to go through this chapter on your own, you'll see a few things in God's laws. Firstly, you'll see laws in which he not only protects the victims, but these laws are also designed to protect the accused. Like there's cases of manslaughter or assault. In a case where there's no malicious intent, he provides opportunity for the accused to be protected. He requires compensation to people for loss and for injury that occurs. So an example is somebody digs a pit and another person's farm animal falls into it, then the pit owner has to pay for that animal. There are situations that demand that people take responsibility for negligence. So another example of this brought up is if someone owns an ox and it has a history of aggression and it gores someone, then the owner is actually found at fault and he's punished because he was negligent in taking care of this difficult animal. Now, throughout here, there's one particular law I'd like to highlight here as well, because I think it helps us understand God's even, you know, more even-handed view of his justice. So here it is. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Now, first, I will admit, this seems like a very weird, very specific situation. Like, what is going on here? But I think the idea is that, you know, there is strife. There's some kind of fight that breaks out, right? And an innocent bystander is injured, specifically a pregnant woman. So perhaps she's trying to intervene because she is the wife of one of these men. She gets hit and it causes her to give birth. So God lays out some guidelines for punishment. He says, if there's no harm to the woman or child, then the guilty person has to pay a fine determined by her husband, okay? But if there is harm, then we get this famous Old Testament phrase, I'm sure you've heard it before, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, etc. You probably heard it before, it's popped up in pop culture, but it's also in Leviticus and Deuteronomy as well, which is a little later in the Bible. But I want to ask you, how many of you, when you hear that phrase, you think, okay, this is that vengeful kind of primitive Old Testament language? Like you associate this with that wrath of Old Testament God. He's calling for vengeance. He's calling for retaliation. Well, actually, the point of this command is not to be vengeful. There's actually an element to this that it's actually restrictive. This, what's being described here, is a legal concept that has become known in Latin as lex talionis. So it's meant to make sure that the punishment fits but does not exceed the crime. Right? So it's not to go beyond the crime that was committed. just think about the situation we just read. Two men are fighting. One man's pregnant wife and unborn child get injured in the process. What do you think that guy is going to do? Like, things are going to get really nasty now. Things are going to escalate real fast. So God, he's not going to let this crime go unpunished, but he's also not going to let excessive violence and retribution kind of take hold either. So he provides guidance again to deal with these situations. God's law states that justice must be served in a way that is equitable. Okay, so deep breath. After wading through all these heavy laws about death penalties and slavery and all this stuff, you know, reading some of these more kind of even-handed things are helpful. It helps make a little more sense. I think my faith in God's justice feels a little better when I understand things like this. And while this concept of lex talionis does help us to understand God's justice, I found that even wrestling through all these difficult questions, I was still left with maybe one final one. One kind of bigger one as I'm kind of reading this and preparing to talk with you guys about it. And that is, why does any of this matter to me? Why does it matter to you? If we are to acknowledge that these laws were written for covenant Israel, for a specific time and place, then why should we care if they don't apply anymore? Why read them all? Why spend all this time today and in the series talking about them? Well, let me share a few thoughts on that, and I'm going to kind of connect these with those questions I had. So in those times when I feel like, okay, is God going too far? Has he gone too far? I think those sections kind of help me appreciate and understand the gravity of my own sin. You know, when I read these laws and their consequences, I begin to see just how holy God is, and I begin to understand how a truly holy God cannot tolerate evil of any kind in his family. He can't allow it to take root and further corrupt his creation. And then when I read about these people in Israel who are held to such high standards, it makes me realize how laissez-faire I maybe treat my relationship with God and how indifferent I can actually be to my own sin. You know, we might not be bound under that same law any longer, but there is still a law for us, right? We feel it and we know it. And that's why I asked Jason to read those verses from Romans today. Paul points this out. He says, there will be tribulation and distress for every human being who does evil. The Jew first, that's who we've been reading about, and also for the Greek, that represents people like us. Paul then went on to say, for when we who do not have the law, like us, by nature do what the law requires, we are a law to ourselves, even though we do not have the law. He says that we show that the work of the law is written on our hearts, while our conscience also bears witness, and our conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse us. So he's saying that even though we're not under that Jewish law, we're still guilty of sin, and our conscience convicts us of this, that there is justice required and punishment still applies. So this makes me think I probably should not be as concerned about whether God goes too far in his punishment as I should be concerned whether I go too far in my sin. So the next thought I have is, okay, so when God seems like he's not doing enough to stop evil in its tracks, in those moments with those difficult unanswered questions about slavery and these kind of things, in those times I'm challenged to trust his wisdom. You know what? I'll be honest, I spent a lot of time reading and researching and thinking over these laws, and I've only shared a fraction of the depth that we could go through. And you know what? To be honest, the answers, they're not always perfectly clear. They're not always all that satisfying. And I didn't want to come up here and sugarcoat things. Like, yes, we can look at things in the Old Testament like slavery, and we can get some context to help us understand it. And you know, we can even come to some good conclusions, like it's not as cruel and demeaning as what we know of as slavery in North American history. But at the end of the day, that doesn't mean it's all going to really sit well with us in our modern sensibilities. There are things in the Old Testament we just struggle to understand that make us uncomfortable, and pat answers don't always satisfy. And in those times, I think we need to look at all of what we know of God and say, okay, if I can trust you, God, in all of this, then I can trust you in this little thing I don't get too. The other thing I think we can learn from difficult passages like this is, you know, I kind of referenced this earlier, just because God allows something to take place doesn't mean he endorses it or approves of it. God can be permissive and patient when he deems it necessary. And we might not understand why he's doing that. You know, he allowed slavery for a time. Does that mean that's his ideal for us? I don't think so. Sometimes my kids can be in an all-out fight, and I will sit on the coffee and I will, or on the couch, and I will drink my coffee, and I will not intervene, because I want them to work that out for themselves. I want them to understand the conflict they're going through. You know, think about it. God allowed Jesus to be sent to the cross by his own people, by these Jewish people we're reading about. That doesn't mean he condones crucifixion of innocent people, but he had a plan for what that could accomplish. So my third and final thought is in those moments when we read and we go, okay, God here is proven to be fair, I think we can at least encourage ourselves that I think I understand his justice. You know, I'm guessing most of us probably don't like the idea of punishment, especially from God, who we want to be loving and forgiving. But we can also create a problem when we try to explain away or ignore the idea of punishment. There's an interesting little essay by C.S. Lewis called The Humanitarian Theory of Punishment. And so he kind of goes down this road. He criticizes two theories of punishment that are kind of aimed at softening the idea of making it more palatable and more humane. And so the first theory he goes after is the idea that punishment should be thought of as a just cure. The idea that it's therapeutic, it's aimed at rehabilitating the offender. And he says, if this is the only purpose of punishment, then there's problems. Because if it's considered therapy or rehabilitation alone, then it's that doesn't mean it's any better or for that person, right? It's still something forced upon someone against their will. That doesn't necessarily mean it's more humane. And the other thing is, rehabilitation then becomes entirely subjective. It becomes the opinion of some expert. Someone could spend their entire life subjected to this rehabilitation and never be considered cured. So how is that just? So the second theory he goes after is that punishment is a deterrent, a just deterrent. That's its primary purpose. And so the problem here is that that removes morality from the equation, because a person doesn't have to even be guilty to be made of as an example to deter other people. Jesus wasn't guilty, and so still he was sacrificed as an example and as a deterrent against his followers. There is no lex talionis in this punishment. It can be scaled as big and awful as needed simply to deter other people. So what's the answer? Instead, C.S. Lewis argues that the traditional view of punishment is the only one that can be considered just, and that is that punishment is actually something deserved for a crime or sin. He says it is only as deserved or undeserved that a sentence can be just or unjust. And so I think this idea supports, you know, some of Paul's writing when he writes things like the wages of sin is death, and that when we are stubborn and refuse to turn from our sin, we are storing up terrible punishment for ourselves. Okay, so I know this is a lot of kind of heady stuff, but let me ask you again. So then why does any of this matter to me? Well, without a correct view of punishment and what it is and what it's for, we can't truly understand or appreciate what Jesus did for us, right? We are separated from God. Our sin is serious. It keeps us from a relationship with our holy God. And Israel and all its laws show us that the climb back to God is very steep, impossible even. But yet we also know that we still need God. We still depend on him. We can't just deny that. We can't deny that we need God and just walk away, because without him, we're utterly lost. Israel and the nations it was trying to reach, and even our own experience, testified how everything just kind of goes to ruin without God. So the only way to be reconciled to God is for his justice to be satisfied, for sin to receive the deserved punishment, not just as correction and not just as a deterrent to others, but because that's what justice requires. And so all that means us human beings are in a really bad spot. You know, as I kind of read all that, I get this feeling, and it conjured up an image in my head. It's like last summer we went to the scenic caves in Collingwood, and there's this narrow crevice known as Fat Man's Misery. Not the most politically correct name, I know, but that's what people call it. And so you go through it, and it narrows to a 36-centimeter gap at its smallest point. And so the only way to go through is to lead with your shoulder and squeeze your way through. Now, I've never known myself to be claustrophobic, but I stepped in and my panic level went through the roof. I had to get out, and it took me two tries to get up the courage to try to make it through. And so when I think of all this pressing on us, you know, between my sin and my need for God, that's the feeling I get, that I'm trapped. But that just reveals the beauty of what Jesus did to save us. This same God that we've been talking about today, who sometimes we look at and we accuse him of being a cruel and strict judge, this same God that sometimes we look at and we go, how could he allow this stuff to happen that we see in the Old Testament? And the same God who we look at and he goes, he requires this justice, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and puts us in this horrible position. That same God gave up his son, the only man on earth who ever was truly innocent, truly sinless. He gave him to take that punishment, the punishment we deserved, so that we could be forgiven, so that the justice that God calls for can be satisfied and we can actually be reconciled to God, that thing that seems impossible, that we can be made holy and righteous, that thing that the Israelites were, you know, striving for. And here's just a little fun bonus point. One of the laws in today's passage, I didn't read to you, I'll read it for you right now. It says that if someone's ox were to gore a slave, a male or a female, the owner shall give their master 30 shekels of silver and the ox shall be stoned. Okay, so if a slave gets killed by an animal, the animal owner owes 30 shekels of silver. Do you remember how much Judas betrayed Jesus for? The religious leaders of that day valued Jesus' life at 30 pieces of silver, the same worth as a slave. God did that for us, right? He subjected him to that for us. I don't think we always, you know, fully appreciate the implications of Christ's death. I don't think even his disciples did at first from what we read. But I think we can learn from someone else. There's someone I think we can learn from who really did get it, who really understood. It's a pretty cool story. He appreciated what Jesus did, and that was a criminal sentenced to death on a cross. You know the story probably. As Jesus was hanging there during his crucifixion, he was hung on the cross between two convicted criminals. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." So that first criminal, that first thief, he shows the attitude we have sometimes, that bristling indignation towards God. How could you let this happen? Why don't you just do something, God? You say you're good. You say you love us. Well, prove it. But then there's this second criminal, and he speaks out of a fear of God. It says the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward for our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." You know, I think one of the reasons the Old Testament laws and their punishments upset us is because we don't want a God that should be feared. That's not the kind of God we really like to have. We would rather tell God how we want him to be, how we think he should be. But that second criminal, he says, "No, what's wrong with you in that thinking? Don't you even fear God? Don't you even fear him?" And then I love what he does here. He goes on to acknowledge that his crime, that his sin was deserving of the punishment he was receiving. The NIV translation actually uses some words that we've been using this morning. It says that he said, "We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve." Just think how amazingly humble and honest that is for a criminal convicted for crime he knows he did to admit that. And with everything we've looked at on this topic this afternoon of punishment, his posture, the posture of his heart, is the one I'm trying to move us toward, myself included. I'm not doing that to be like a Debbie Downer on a long weekend, not to heap like a whole bunch of guilt on us, but because I think we need to know how bad the bad news is in order to fully appreciate how good the good news is. Because that criminal, he didn't just stop there and say, "Oh, I'm terrible and I deserve this." And he didn't just wallow in his guilt. He then had the guts to ask Jesus for something. He said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And then Jesus answered him. He said, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." You know, I think the thief was desperately begging for some mercy, some kind of mercy, anything. You'd take anything at this point. And can you imagine what Jesus gave him? That thief knew he deserved punishment, and Jesus instead gave him paradise. So why should we care about the laws in the book of Exodus? I think God wants us to understand the gravity of our sin, but he doesn't want to just leave us there. He doesn't want us just to be stuck in our fear and dread between sin and the requirement of justice. You know, when we went to those caves, I made it through the cave. I got through the other side. And through all that panic, man, what a relief it was to come out the other side. God wants to see us through our sin, through our fear, through the punishment owed to us that Jesus took on our behalf. He wants to see us through to the other side. And that's some really, really good news.
Join us every Sunday at 4 p.m. at 7755 10th Line West in Mississauga. Or visit us online at renewchurch.ca/connect.